Europe is experiencing the largest wave of refugees since World War II and is desperate to find a long-term solution. Join America Abroad for a town hall discussion linking New York to Berlin on iTunes and PRI.org/America Abroad.
China scraps its one-child policy today on The World. I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman. China's Communist Party says couples can now have two kids, not just one. And some in Beijing are happy about it.
I think it shows our country is more open than before. So I'm really happy about the news today.
Also, where the U.S. stands in the fight against Islamic extremism.
Al-Qaeda is not losing, ISIS is not losing, and they're not fighting each other. They're competing for leadership of the movement.
Plus, winter is looming across Europe, but the tide of migrants hasn't been affected much at all.
You see people coming out of these boats sopping wet, and the children are the most vulnerable.
Those stories, plus what the word Texas means in Persian. It's all ahead, right here on The World.
The World is brought to you with support from Audible.com. With over 180,000 audiobooks, Audible is a core tool for anyone seeking to be more productive, better informed, and thoughtfully entertained. You can learn more at audible.com/theworld. And from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, you can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. Big change today for China. The Communist Party there has decided to scrap the country's famous one-child policy. Some might say infamous policy. We're going to get a couple of perspectives on this. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a one-child herself. But first, we turn to The World's Mary Kay Magstad. She was our Beijing correspondent for years and reported extensively on the one-child policy and family issues in China. Mary Kay, the policy was originally created decades ago to control China's population. Why is it being scrapped now?
Well, I think one reason why the government is scrapping it now is because the workforce is shrinking, the population is aging. Previous attempts to try to get the birth rate, the fertility rate to go up a bit have failed. And so the government and the party are seeing that they need to take more steps to try to get Chinese to have more kids. So I think the party is recognizing that, having been so concerned that population growth would become a massive problem for China, now it's starting to recognize that the opposite may be at least as big of a problem.
Now, what's coming instead is essentially a two-child policy. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. And I think this is an important distinction to make. This is not the Communist Party saying, hey, families, have as many kids as you want. Recognizing that at this point in China's economic development, most families are probably only going to have one or two kids. And in fact, that squares with what demographers are finding throughout China, not just in the cities, not just among the affluent, but also among the aspiring rural population, where, you know, they want their kids to go to good schools, they want them to do better than they've done. And housing is extremely expensive. You know, tuition at all levels is extremely expensive once you get past ninth grade. Healthcare remains very expensive in China. So families look at, you know, how can we afford to get even one kid through everything that they need to go through and still have, you know, enough money, you know, save for a rainy day in case of some sort of emergency, you know, our child falls off her bike and breaks her arm or something else happens to someone else in the family. You know, we can just about do that with one kid. How could we possibly do it with two?
The Chinese government always touts this figure of 400 million children or 400 million people that weren't born as a result of the one-child policy. The other side of that is that there were some terrible abuses for many individuals. I remember you reporting on the story of one woman, Tang Licheng. What happened to her?
Right. So this is a woman in Yunnan province in the southwest of China who had applied for permission to have a second child. She got permission to have a second child. There was no expiration date on the permission slip, but the problem was in her district, there's a quota system, and local governments were rewarded for hitting their quota. You can only have so many births in your district this year. And her district was already hitting its quota, so it didn't want any more births. So they found out rather late in the game that she was pregnant. She was 8 months pregnant. And decided, oh, this won't look good for us in terms of our, you know, the promotions we want to get. So they dragged her out of her home and into a hospital and made her have an abortion, made her pay for the abortion. Later, the central government agreed with her that there was no policy that allowed the government to cancel her permission to have the second child, but she was never compensated. And she fought for years and I believe continues to fight to get compensation, financial compensation, but also, most of all, she wants an apology. She wants recognition that the system really screwed her over, and she's still very angry about it.
Hmm. Do you imagine any time in the future that there'll be a kind of, you know, truth and reconciliation kind of deal, or people will really, officials really examine and reflect on this policy, the good and the bad, or is it just kind of, do you expect the government to just move on and forget about it?
That's a really good question, and I think it goes to the heart of what the relationship is between the Communist Party and the people of China. And I think at this moment, under this administration in China, the government is really not in a mood to admit that it's made any major mistakes, certainly not related to the one-child policy. Certainly there are demographers and many Chinese who have said that this has been an atrocious series of human rights abuses over decades visited upon the Chinese population, and that it was unnecessary, that as China's economy grew and as people became more affluent, more educated, the same thing would have happened in China that has happened in many other developing countries, that the birth rate would have dropped naturally by itself, as it had already begun to do in the 1970s.
The world's Mary Kay Magstad. Sunny Yang lives in Beijing. We spoke with her last month on the 35th anniversary of the one-child policy. Sunny's an only child and herself the mother of an only child, at least for now. So we wanted to check in with her to get her reaction to today's news that China's one-child policy is no more.
I'm very happy about new change. I think it shows our country is more open than before. And I think the policymakers could keep pace with the times. So I'm really happy about the news today.
What have your friends been saying about it?
You know, there is a popular app called WeChat in China, and people share their feelings on the friend circle. And for example, one female friend in her 30s wrote, "Oh, great. I think I really want to find a way to have a twin, though it's easier for me." And other friends think, "Oh, it's really a time for me to buy an apartment in Beijing because of the new policy." They are sure the house price will rise quickly in the near future.
So you're saying because of the new policy, because of the ability to have a second child, people are going to want bigger houses?
Right. If you have a small house in the past, if you want one more kid, you must change a house, then change a car.
It's interesting. You live in Beijing, but you're from Wuhan.
Yes.
And that has an impact, doesn't it, on if you have another child, how you'll pay for health care and things like that. Do you have to go back to Wuhan to do that?
I'm lucky because although I don't have a Beijing hukou, my husband has a Beijing hukou. So our son has a Beijing hukou. He could enjoy the health care in Beijing.
And of course, the hukou system is where you're from is where you will enjoy certain benefits like free health care and other things. And even if you live in another city, you have to return in order to enjoy those benefits or pay out of pocket where you are now.
Many friends of ours have the problem. They worked in Beijing for quite a long time, and their kid can't take the college entrance exam in Beijing, and the health care is also a headache for them. It's a headache for many families who don't have a hukou.
Have you ever talked to your parents about what it was like for them to only have one child? Was it tougher for them because they were the first generation to live under those rules?
My parents, they really obeyed every rules in their city. They really patriotic, and I don't think they think a lot about it. They like me. I'm lucky if they could have one more kid, if another kid is a son. I really don't know whether they will love my brother more than me.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
You allude to sort of a sex preference. Sunny, do you feel like this is the beginning of more changes in China, like possibly a change to the hukou system, which you talked about?
Yes, I think so. Although I still think it's hard for Beijing to change the hukou system. But for cities like my hometown Wuhan and other second or third tier cities, there are some reforms in Hukou system, the urbanization, and more farmers lost their land, so they got a city Hukou too.
Sunny Yang is an only child, and she also has one child of her own. She lives in Beijing. Thanks so much, Sunny.
Thank you.
When it comes to governments dictating how their citizens live, few places can outdo North Korea. Authorities there aggressively control people's daily lives. One example, they ban North Koreans from leaving without permission. But there are more cracks in the system than you might realize, as the World's Matthew Bell reports.
It's just one family, but Grace Jo's story is a pretty damning indictment of the whole North Korean system. In the famine of the late 1990s, Grace's little brother died of starvation. One sister headed for China in search of food and disappeared. Grace's dad crossed the border into China illegally. He got arrested, and he died in prison. Grace, her surviving sister, and their mother escaped to China. They spent years living as fugitives, but they were detained and sent back to North Korea. Grace says it was a Korean-American missionary who saved their lives by coming up with a $10,000 bribe.
Where would you be right now if the pastor didn't help you?
Well, I probably already died in North Korea because at that time, back in 2004, my family tried to help North Korean refugees escape China to South Korea. And also we were Christians in China, and also we met Korean-American. So North Korean regime very strongly believe those three sections are biggest crime in North Korea. So if they found out our family committed all these three crimes, then we probably sent her back to political prison camp or just like a sample, like public execution.
Instead of fearing public execution, 24-year-old Grace Jo just finished her GED. She works part-time in a dental office, and she's applying for college. I met her at a conference about human rights in North Korea in Washington this week. Kim Song-min was there. He's another defector from North Korea, living in Seoul, South Korea. For about 10 years, Kim has operated a radio station there that broadcasts into the North. Kim says a lot has changed in the last decade, and to make the point, he shows me a smartphone video. It's a scene of people in North Korea hanging out at home and singing songs. Kim says more than 3 million people in the North have smartphones now, and the fact that people are sending videos to the outside world is a real challenge to the regime's grip on information. Kim says people are smuggling all kinds of things into North Korea, cell phones, handheld radios, USB drives. They provide a link to the outside world and a challenge to the regime. But these kinds of cross-border activities might be getting more difficult. According to a recent investigation by The Intercept news website, the Pentagon used a Christian missionary group operating in Northeast China and North Korea to carry out espionage activities. The spying allegedly went on between 2005 and 2012, according to the story, but it apparently wasn't a major operation. Still, North Korea expert Joel Witt of Johns Hopkins University says it plays into the worst fears of the North Koreans about what they describe as hostile U.S. policy.
The message is that we're out to get them, you know, that the United States is really interested in regime change, and we're using programs that might be intended for engagement really for that purpose.
Whether it's true or not, a story in the Western news media about collaboration between the U.S. military and a Christian aid group working in North Korea could lead to big trouble for people on the ground. Again, here's Kim Song-min from Free North Korea Radio. Kim recalls an incident a few years ago when a Christian missionary group went public with mobile phone videos of North Koreans secretly practicing their faith inside North Korea. He says state security tracked down the worshippers, arrested them, and accused them of being Western spies. That's a treasonous offense in North Korea. Kim says it's a catch-22. Activists need support from the West to help bring down the North Korean regime, but that very support, or even the perception of it, puts those activists in even greater danger. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. This week, another hospital run by the medical charity Doctors Without Borders was bombed. This time it happened in northern Yemen. And the group, also known as MSF, blamed the Saudi-led coalition that's conducting airstrikes in the country. Saudi Arabia, though, has denied responsibility and called for a thorough investigation. Just weeks ago, it was an MSF hospital in Afghanistan that was bombed by the U.S. And the White House apologized for that. Natalie Roberts is a physician with Doctors Without Borders. We spoke to her recently about working in the same hospital in Yemen that was hit this week. She's now in London.
From what I heard, the staff were in the hospital, and the first airstrike landed about 10:30 at night and hit a part of the hospital which isn't often used at night, which meant that the staff had a short period of time to get themselves and the patients that we had in the hospital out. So as they were moving away from the hospital, the second airstrike then hit another part of the hospital. Over the period of about 90 minutes, the airstrikes completely destroyed the hospital building. Luckily, none of the staff or patients were severely injured, but there were a few minor injuries.
So where are the patients that would have used that hospital? Where's the nearest hospital for them now?
It's going to be very difficult for patients to access medical care now. The nearest hospital will be our own MSF hospital, which is down in Sadr City, but it's a 90-minute drive away from the location that we had that hospital. Because many of the patients were coming from further afield, were coming from closer to the Saudi border, it means that actually some patients now will not survive that distance, the 3-, 4-, 5-hour journey it will take them to get down into Sadr City.
What was it like working there on a daily basis? I mean, was there sort of an average routine?
It was pretty terrifying. I mean, I didn't spend every day in that hospital. I used to go up at least once a week. It was a town that was very heavily bombed by airstrikes almost, you know, every day. And so moving up to that place was terrifying. And then being in that place was often also frequently scary.
Was it the kind of thing where you're working in a hospital and you can hear the airstrikes around you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, every day I was there, every time I stepped there or spent any time there at all, you'd hear the planes flying around.
When we last spoke to you, you told us about one patient in particular, a boy who had been injured. Here's the audio diary you recorded.
I'm in the emergency room of a health centre that we've been supporting in the mountains of North Yemen. There's a 6-year-old boy here with a piece of shrapnel in his eye that he sustained this morning. It means he's lost his eye. Still covered in blood, unfortunately. His mother's talking to him.
Natalie, have you found out what happened to that boy?
I know he got taken down. We have another hospital that we're running in Sadr City. Which continues to run and hasn't been damaged by the airstrike. So we took him down to that hospital and he had an operation to remove his eye.
So how well was this hospital marked? I mean, if you're flying overhead, if you're about to conduct an airstrike, can you tell that if there's a hospital below?
I would hope so. We'd given our GPS coordinates of the hospital to the Saudi-led coalition frequently. I mean, usually at least once a week. I know we'd given the GPS coordinates a couple of days before the airstrikes happened. And at the same time, our team had painted very large MSF logos on the roof of the hospital, and they refreshed them quite frequently to make sure they were visible.
You know, this comes on the heels of this awful bombing on the hospital in the MSF hospital in Afghanistan, which the U.S. has apologized for. But are you worried that the taboo against striking humanitarian targets may be getting weaker?
It does feel that maybe there's an increasing disrespect for international humanitarian law. It very clearly says in international humanitarian law that hospitals should be protected. Hospitals should not be hit. In Yemen, it seems that since the airstrike started, many civilian targets, such as hospitals, schools, markets, have been frequently bombed. And this is just another example of that.
Natalie Roberts of Doctors Without Borders speaking to us from London. We've heard about those Saudi-led airstrikes in Yemen and the Houthi fighters targeted by those bombs, but there's another group in Yemen we don't hear about much.
The Yemeni branch of al-Qaeda is the al-Qaeda node that has actually conducted the most transnational attacks against the United States since 9/11.
Catherine Zimmerman of the American Enterprise Institute. She says al-Qaeda in Yemen remains a big threat to the U.S.
It has attempted repeatedly, year after year, since its inception in 2009, to strike the United States. That capability has not been destroyed.
What specific attacks are you referring to?
The December 2009 attempt to bring down a U.S. airliner over the United States, the underwear bomber, as he's become known. And then one that's been forgotten, a plot in 2010 in October where AQAP hid bombs in printer cartridges and shipped them to the United States.
And AQAP is al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
Yes. This group is one that is innovative and still seeking to bring down some sort of attack against the United States.
And what's been their presence in Yemen since the civil war there began?
Al-Qaeda controls a port city in Yemen and has held it since April. It's been using Al-Mukalla, the port city, as a base from which to support the front line against the Houthis, moving in supplies, training individuals, and then shipping those forward to the front lines to fight against the Houthis within Yemen's civil war.
And who is supplying AQAP in Yemen?
AQAP actually sits on top of a tribal network. It has local knowledge of who can deliver what arms, and these are historic black market smuggling networks that haven't been shut down in decades, centuries. They're not going to be closed that easily.
Now, it all gets kind of murky for the outside observer. We've got AQAP, we've got ISIS, we've got Houthis, we've got Saudi strikes. Is there sort of a Venn diagram that includes AQAP and ISIS or any other group, or are there really distinct and separate group in Yemen right now?
They are a different group, but they're both part of the same movement, and this is something that should be drawn out. AQAP, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the Islamic State, they are all part of the global jihadist movement, and that movement is doing very, very well globally. Al-Qaeda is not losing, ISIS is not losing, and they're not fighting each other. They're competing for leadership of the movement. So we're looking at a much stronger radical Islamist threat to the West.
Now, you've argued that the U.S. should take a much stronger role in targeting AQAP in Yemen. What should the U.S. be doing in your mind?
The U.S. needs to be taking a more active role in Yemen in both resolving this conflict, because the longer the war drags out, the stronger Al-Qaeda and ISIS are getting in Yemen, but also in working with non-state actors to fight against Al-Qaeda in the East. There are tribal groups that are both anti-government, which will be a problem longer term, and there are ways to work around that, but also very much anti-Al-Qaeda, and they're willing to fight the group. They just need some sort of support and backing, and they've actually asked publicly for this. So that's one vector by which the United States can really put pressure on Al-Qaeda without much of a commitment.
How do you persuade a reluctant U.S. government to do that? There are so many competing areas, I mean, Syria among them. I mean, how do you get the U.S. all excited about Yemen?
It's really hard to put Yemen on top of a priority list, and frankly, it's not. When you're looking at the threats the United States faces, Syria is certainly much higher than Yemen. But when you are looking at the threat from the global jihadist movement, then Yemen falls into place. And the bigger problem that we have is the United States doesn't have a comprehensive strategy that's working to fight against ISIS and Al-Qaeda. We're hitting them piecemeal in Syria or Iraq or in Yemen, but there isn't a broader grand strategy to tie everything that we're doing together.
Catherine Zimmerman is a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and the lead Al-Qaeda analyst for AEI's Critical Threats Project. Thanks a lot, Catherine.
Thank you.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. When I say Texas, what comes to mind?
A place where there are no rules. A cowboy town. You could be dead anytime. You should be very careful. You should not mess with scary, dangerous people.
Yeah, and that's just in Persian. What Texas means in different languages. It's coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International and by Soundworks.org, a collection of podcasts from PRI with global voices and perspectives. From Studio 360 to America Abroad, explore and subscribe at Soundworks.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Icy waters and raw, blustery winds are not deterring the desperate refugees and migrants who continue to land on the Greek island of Lesbos. Every day brings more people. Yesterday, a wooden trawler that left Turkey crammed with more than 300 migrants capsized in the Aegean Sea. 8 migrants are confirmed dead. About 30 are still missing. Survivors joined the crowds on the island, where aid workers say they're slammed.
10 boats arriving at once and thousands of people, and they're just shivering and cold and wet. You know, we don't have the clothes to give them. I mean, they're, you know, we go through the clothes and everything so fast.
Allison Thompson is one of the doctors trying to help new arrivals on Lesbos. She spoke with reporter Jean Carstensen. Jean says she herself has witnessed the daily arrival of wet, scared migrants in rubber dinghies, including several children suffering from hypothermia and a 6-year-old girl who rescuers struggled to revive in the dining room of a small restaurant.
This girl was rushed into a taverna. They quickly set up an emergency center on a table, and doctors went to work on her. From what I understand, her heart stopped, and she also had extreme hypothermia. She was very close to death. A taverna owner was desperately calling an ambulance to come. The nearest ambulance was an hour away in Mytilene because there was no oxygen in this little village. Thankfully, the ambulance arrived and they were able to revive her and rush her to a hospital in Mytilene.
Wow. It's just a very tough story to even hear about. I know later you talked to a Swedish doctor, Carl Tosterud, who attended her. Let's listen to what he had to say.
She is now responding. She's eating and she can talk a little bit. So it gives me the chills, really, because we actually brought her back. We really did. Yeah.
Now, it sounds like what happened yesterday was extreme, but I understand it's happening now about every day. Is that true?
Well, yes. Every day there are many, many rescues, and cases of hypothermia are very much on the rise. It's cool here now. The water itself is colder, and we've had some very high winds. So there are more rescues, more people in the water. You see people coming out of these boats sopping wet, and the children are the most vulnerable. Almost every day now, there's some kind of tragedy going on here.
Jean, I want to follow up and just ask, what happened to that six-year-old girl after she was revived?
I think she is with her family, so let's hope that she will recover and be all right.
I understand there's a trailer set up on the beach at Sinemania, and it's a bit chaotic inside. I know you spoke with a doctor there who treats the children and infants as they come out of the sea when they're wet and possibly suffering from hypothermia, and often when they arrive at night. Let's listen to Dr. Michael van Horsten.
We basically triage them. So the smaller babies come in first, the wetter ones come in first. All the kids that are, dry, we obviously send them on with the mom. We just give them a space blanket, just depending on our resources. A lot of kids having chest infections at the moment and upper respiratory infections. But most of them respond pretty well to just being warmed, which is great.
Looks like you have a long line out there right now.
Yeah, they are quite long. Let me just have a look quickly.
Jean, how long was the line outside?
Oh, there were about 50 people, mothers clutching their babies. It was about 8 o'clock at night. It was very, very cold. Everybody was very wet. And really, there's nothing exceptional about this situation. This is a small trailer. It's staffed by Greek doctors, doctors from all over the world, and a lot of volunteers. Half of it's filled with clothing, and people are just doing whatever they can every single day to try and keep people alive and just keep them moving on to the next step, which is a refugee camp.
Refugee camp on Lesbos.
Yes, refugee camps on Lesbos. They have a long journey by bus to get there, and then their journey continues.
Jean, the conditions sound really tough. I know it's getting colder and colder, and the dangers are getting worse and worse as we get toward winter. When you talk to the refugees who are still making the journey, what do they tell you about why they're still doing this at this point in the year? What is motivating them?
I don't think the motivations have changed. About 64% of the refugees come from Syria. We know there's a terrible war going on there. But the rest come from Iraq, Afghanistan, from Iran, and many of them tell stories about fleeing conflict. Some of them tell me about hoping for education, a better life for their children. But overall, there is a sense that people are desperate, and they're so desperate that they will cross these waters. And it's not only these boat trips. Of course, we know what is ahead for them. They have to move up into the Balkans and into Europe, and that's not an easy journey either.
That's correspondent Jean Carstensen on the Greek island of Lesbos. Her work is supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Thanks, Jean.
Thank you, Carol.
For our next story, we go to a place we don't hear a lot from, the tiny country of Tajikistan. A little background might help. Tajikistan is to the north of Afghanistan, and it's one of the countries where Persian is spoken. And that's what's made it a go-to place for American students who want to learn Persian, or Farsi, as it's also called. Reporter Miriam Berger was in Tajikistan, and she's reported about this for BuzzFeed. Miriam, first, give us a sense of what Tajikistan is like. You know, it's one of those stands we hear about once in a while. I mean, what do you see when you get there?
Well, Tajikistan is largely mountainous and very rural. Most foreigners hang out in just very few cities, mainly the capital, Dushanbe, which means Monday in Persian. It's a pretty new city, just started about a century ago, and kind of humdrum. There's one major boulevard. You don't really have many big chains there or kind of any of the places kind of associated with some other more cosmopolitan cities. So people are, you know, generally friendly. It's a good quiet place to be, I would say.
So why do Americans go there to study Persian?
So there are sort of three main branches of the Persian language. There's Iranian Farsi, and then there's Dari, which is one of the two main languages spoken in Afghanistan. And then there's Tajik, which is also from the Persian family. So Americans come to Tajikistan to study Persian because, in theory, people do speak Persian there. It's a place that has good relations with the U.S., and so it's easy to get your visas. It's relatively very, very safe, so, you know, Americans and most other people can just walk around and have no problems. And it's been pretty quiet and stable.
If American students wanted to, could they go to Iran to study Persian?
Yes, they can, and it's increasingly possible to do so via getting a student visa via universities or going as a tourist on a tourist visa via tourist groups. But the students I was focusing on for this story were the ones that are on U.S.-funded programs and on U.S. government grants. And U.S. money can't be sending students to Iran because of there's no formal diplomatic relations.
What did the American students you spoke with who are in Dushanbe, what did they tell you about living and studying in Tajikistan?
The ones I spoke to were, you know, pretty happy to be doing so. They were in their first month. So they, you know, it was a small group, just seven. So they were living with families, Tajik families, who all of them said, you know, there were definitely weird moments, but in general, they felt comfortable with their families.
What about the Persian that they're learning? Is it comparable to the Persian they'd be learning in Iran?
Definitely not. So this is sort of the crux of the issue in many ways. The Persian that they're learning is very influenced by Russian. For Dari and for Persian spoken in Iran, you write with the Arabic script. For Tajiks, they write with Cyrillic because they were a Soviet state. And so there's lots of words and phrases and just sort of colloquialisms that that are Russian or very influenced by Russian. Generally, if you're a good Persian speaker, a Tajik will understand you with no issue and vice versa. But for, you know, just learning out even the way you pronounce certain words, where you put the emphasis, there are a lot of differences.
So did any of the American students you spoke with say, you know, gee, what am I doing here? Turns out the Persian's different and I'm bored.
None of them quite put it that way. You know, I think these are all smart kids who, you know, think about what they're doing. And so I think they knew that this was a cost benefit. You know, one student I spoke to said, yeah, of course I'd be in Iran if I could, but he's on a prestigious fellowship that's paying for him to be in Tajikistan. He wants to work maybe in government or business sectors in the future. So he's worried about security clearances. And so he knows that this is his option. I mean, he said, you know, I had studied at a immersion program in the U.S. At a U.S. university, and that was better, he said, for Persian, for Iranian Persian. So there's no perfect place to go study right now.
What kind of jobs will these American students get when they return to the U.S.?
It depends. You know, there's a core group that was part of West Point, so they'll be heading into the military. Some of them expressed interest in working in various parts of the military. And other students said they'd like to work for USAID, in business, perhaps as diplomats. You know, everyone said that there was something government-related that they were interested in.
Miriam Berger is a contributing reporter for BuzzFeed. She was just in Tajikistan and reported about Americans who go there to study Persian. Thanks, Miriam.
Thank you.
You'll hear some Persian in our next story, but it's really about the name of one of our United States of America and what it means to people around the globe. Here's Ashley Kleek to explain.
In Norwegian, if you want to say something is totally out of control, you would say,
Helt Texas.
Helt Texas.
It's like, this is completely Texas.
Emily Klovning is a student in her first semester at Columbia University in New York. She says Norwegians use the phrase, completely Texas, to describe a situation that's wild and chaotic, like a crazy soccer match or a party. Not in a negative way, just the opposite of normal life in Norway.
Where everything is very calm, people strive to like not get carried away. And if that ever happens, if something feels chaotic or if people are talking loudly, and then we'd say it's completely Texas.
Emily doesn't know how Texas came into Norwegian. Maybe it's from cowboy movies, or maybe the TV show Dallas that was insanely popular all over the world.
Tomorrow morning, the janitor's going to come in here and sweep you out with the rest of the trash. Unless, of course, you do the honorable thing. Get in the elevator, go up the roof, and jump off, huh?
But Texas, it's not just an adjective in Norwegian. The first time I noticed it was in Persian.
Inja Texas nist.
Or, it's not Texas here. That's my husband, Reza Jamiran. For him and other Iranians, Texas means
a place where there are no rules. It's chaotic there. A cowboy town. You could be dead anytime. You should be very careful. You should not mess with scary, dangerous people.
So, for example, if someone's driving erratically, you would say, Inja Texas nist. It's not Texas here. Meaning, we have rules here, and you should follow them. If something violent happens in a neighborhood, Iranians might refer to that part of town as Texas. In Turkish, there's a similar phrase, Burası Texas değil, which means the exact same thing. It's not Texas here. While it's easier to notice this in foreign languages, it happens in English all the time, too. It's called metonymy, using a word as a symbol for a bigger idea. When I was a kid, my mom would drive my brother to a lacrosse game across town, and she would complain that she had to drive to Timbuktu and back. And I swear, for years, I thought Timbuktu was a suburb of Birmingham, Alabama. So why specifically Texas?
Texas was like the Uber United States.
Dr. Deborah Tannen is a linguistics professor at Georgetown University. She thinks Texas acts as a stand-in for an out-of-control place, because it's famous all over the world and still so foreign.
And I think the more exotic the source, the more flexible its meaning would be. So Texas is so exotic to Persians or Norwegians.
So exotic that Texas can stand in for things that are totally unacceptable in those cultures. Reza, my husband, had another idea of how Texas became a staple in Persian.
Maybe this really famous cartoon also was Lucky Luke? Have you seen that one? He might be also from Texas.
I have never seen Lucky Luke. In fact, I doubt many Americans have. Lucky Luke was a comic strip written in French by a Belgian cartoonist way back in the 1940s. Lucky Luke's a good-natured cowboy who keeps the riffraff off the streets of his Texas town. The comic was super popular across Europe and the Middle East for decades. And in the 80s and 90s, Hanna-Barbera, you know, the producers of The Flintstones and The Jetsons, made an animated TV series. And that series was a centerpiece of my husband's weekend cartoon watching in Iran. We found the Persian language version on YouTube, just like he used to watch. Lucky Luke is riding his horse across a pretty basic backdrop, repeating cacti and a mesa. It's all desert and sand and saloon doors swinging. And this is what Reza figured Texas looked like, until we went there. We drove to Texas last year for a friend's wedding, Austin, to be specific. And of course, Reza didn't expect shootouts or bandits, but still.
I think I was a little bit surprised because, you know, it's something that, you know, you heard about it your whole life, and then you're there, you know. It's surprising, certainly, but I wasn't nervous.
When we arrived, he called his mom in Tehran to say he was in Texas.
I wanted to see what's their reaction. Would they say, like, be careful?
She wasn't worried. I could hear her laugh through the phone. The same way my mom would probably laugh if I called her from Timbuktu. For the world, I'm Ashley Cleek.
We have more stories like this on our language podcast, The World in Words. Catch it on iTunes or at pri.org/language. By the way, this song is in Persian, and yes, the refrain goes, Inja Texas Nist. This is not Texas. Talking about sex in remote Arctic villages in Canada. That's next, here on The World.
The World's Global Nation education coverage is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, supporting communities as they work to end the dropout crisis. AmericanGraduate.org.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. Okay, it's time to have that conversation, you know, about sex. How many parents have had that awkward moment with their teenage kids? Fact is, talking about sex is kind of uncomfortable for most of us. But Candice Less does it all the time. She travels around Canada's far north, visiting remote Arctic villages and Indigenous communities, and she helps teens there talk about sex. Less is co-founder of FOXY, which stands for Fostering Open Expression Among Youth. Now, you have an interesting way to break the ice with the teens you work with, which can elicit first giggles and then some naughty words. What do you do?
Well, the first thing we do when we start a workshop is we sit down, and as an icebreaker, we have the youth talk about every word they've ever heard to describe penis or vagina. So, I mean, we've heard everything.
Like what?
You'd like me to repeat some of the words?
No, we don't have to go there.
At first, usually there's some shyness. You know, somebody usually breaks the ice and says, you know, that first kind of taboo word. And then eventually, you know, they start warming up to the idea and the names just start flowing.
What is it about your method that's different from the way you were taught sex ed?
FOXY is a very hands-on, innovative method to teach about sexual health and to facilitate discussions that I don't think normally would occur.
I understand there's particular issues you're trying to address as well about teenage girls living in the North in Canada.
The North does have a lot of these statistics. So we have higher rates of reported sexual violence in the North. We have higher rates of sexually transmitted infections and higher rates of teenage pregnancy. So there's a lot of room for this education that we're doing.
I know you have a peer leader with you named Jessie Shaw.
Hi.
Hey, Jessie. I know you ran a session this morning in a school in Fort Smith. How did that session go?
Fort Smith is like one of the places we love coming the most because like the girls are just so engaged and they're so like coming into their own. It's like a hub of like aspiring little feminists. So we all like get along really well and it's awesome.
Tell us about one of your recent sessions and the kind of things that the girls were able to talk about that they weren't able to talk about before.
We do something called a question box, and like a lot of really good discussion comes up in that. We get like questions on trans issues. We get questions on like sexualities and virginity and like the whole nine. And it just like once we're in that environment and we're all just like asking anonymous questions and answering them honestly, people just feel so comfortable with the dialogue. Yeah, it goes really far and really awesome.
What's different about talking about sex ed in the far north?
So this is Candice here. I grew up in a small town of 2,500 people, which is Fort Smith. My mom is the nurse practitioner for the town. So if my mom comes in to teach sex ed, you know, there's me, there's my cousins, there's my sister. All of us in the school are getting taught sex ed from our mom. So one of the beauties of FOXY is that we go to all the small communities. Youth can be really honest with us and open with us, ask us anything they want, knowing that after we leave, they don't have to see us tomorrow. We're not their moms who are, you know, running the health center.
How explicit do you get? Is it about sex is good and don't feel bad about it and this is how to go about it in a healthy way? Or is it trying to answer their questions, whatever their questions may be?
It's everything. It's about arming them with the knowledge and the skills to be able to make the best decisions for themselves. Whether or not that's to have sex, that's up to them. So it's more about answering their questions so that they can make the best decisions for themselves later on. We often get questions about birth control. You know, will birth control make me fat? How do I put on a condom? Can the ring get lost up inside of me? Questions like this that they wouldn't necessarily feel comfortable just asking random people about.
What are you hoping to accomplish? Is it making them comfortable with talking about sex? What's appropriate and what's not? What's your overarching goal?
Teach teenagers that talking about sex is okay. It's okay to own your sexuality and to be whoever you are. You know, our ultimate goal is at FOXY is that every girl who's involved with our program, you know, feels better about herself when she leaves.
Where else in the Arctic region will you be traveling?
So we're traveling all across the Northwest Territories, and now we're starting to travel into Nunavut and the Yukon. So all three Canadian territories.
Candice Less is co-founder of FOXY, and Jessie Shaw is a peer leader. They help Canadian teenagers in the Arctic region understand sex and avoid sexual violence and unwanted pregnancies. Thanks, Candice and Jessie.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And speaking of sex ed and awkward moments, our friend Deepak Singh sent us this audio postcard.
The other day I was walking around the University of Michigan campus, and I stumbled on a store.
I opened the door and found myself surrounded by vibrators and an array of condoms. A woman behind the counter greeted me and said, "Welcome to the Safe Sex Store. How can I help you?" I told her I was just looking. I felt awkward and uncomfortable. My mind started to wander off to a time when I was a teenager in India, and how awkward it got watching TV with my family when a condom ad popped up. It was 1987 or 88. I was in ninth grade. My parents had recently bought a television, a black and white set encased in a wooden cabinet. We were excited. There was only one channel, and the programming only started after 6 p.m. My family would gather to watch TV. No one wanted to miss their TV time, because we knew we had to get whatever we could between the power cuts and bad reception. Television was such a novelty that we didn't even want to miss the commercials. But every time a commercial about condoms popped up, my family froze. My parents and my sister and I didn't know what to say. My 7-year-old brother would ask my father, "What's that, Papa?" We kept staring at the screen without uttering a word. No one smiled. No one fidgeted. We just waited for the ad to end. 30 seconds seemed like 3 hours. In the store, my reverie passed quickly, though, when I heard, "Let me know if you have any questions." The saleswoman smiled at me. To make conversation, I asked her what the store was about. She said the place welcomed all kinds of sex-related questions, and that they help people engage in safe sex. I told her that as someone who grew up in India, I was struck by the absence of condom ads here. Sex is everywhere in American media and culture, and yet people don't seem to talk about birth control. In India, the condom ads are everywhere. You can always talk about contraception, but what you cannot talk about openly is sex. I said goodbye to the lady in the sex store and walked out thinking what it would be like to have a store like that in India, where people could walk in and out freely and talk about sexuality and seek help with no stigma and shame.
That's Deepak Singh from his perch in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And one quick note before we go. As Deepak could tell you, moving between countries often makes you rethink the things you take for granted. Yesterday on the show, I spoke to my BBC colleague Jaime Gonzalez about how he had to rethink race after coming to the U.S. from his native Spain. There, he's white. Here, he keeps being told his race is Hispanic. His story struck a chord with many of you. So tell us, has your identity changed over time or across borders? Leave us a comment at facebook.com/PRI the world. We want to hear from you. I'm Carol Hills from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. Thanks for tuning in.
World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge in memory of Debbie Sitt, Cindy and Howard Rachofsky, and the Billy and Dodie Crockett Advised Fund of the Dallas Foundation, by the Ford Foundation, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the Annenberg Foundation, Advancing a Better Tomorrow Through Visionary Leadership Today, annenbergfoundation.org, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.